We are going to be in 1 Samuel chapter 14 tonight. So we have been doing, over the past several weeks, we are actually in part 5, I think, or is it part 6? I forget where we're at exactly. But anyways, we are continuing our study on the life of King Saul. Again, he's a complicated character, and we're learning that very quickly. And today is no exception of his, you never know what you're going to get with him, and we're going to find that out tonight. So with that in mind, the life of King Saul, as we've mentioned before, is a study of contrast. And tonight we're going to look at another major contrast in Saul's life. And it's a warning. His life is a warning to us that we cannot rebel against God and get away with it. You think Saul was given the crown. He was given the kingdom in a way. And he really misused it. We're going to find out today that he was derelict on duty. So just kind of all over the place type of personality. So right as we get into chapter 14, just a very brief review. We kind of started back in 1 Samuel chapter 8 and the need for a king. Remember, the children of Israel wanted to have a king like all the other nations. They wanted to keep up with the Joneses or the Babylonians or the Egyptians or whatever country you name it. They wanted to be like them. But God had actually set in the book of Deuteronomy a plan for a king that they would have, but they did it in their own way. So God gave them a king after the desire of their heart, and King Saul came. And remember, one thing to kind of notice when you do a personal Bible study, when you're looking through the scriptures, is look for first impressions. Does anyone remember what was the first impression we're given of King Saul? How is he described? Tall, dark, and handsome, right? Head and shoulders above everyone else. He would be the fitting image of, like, man, if you're going to have a leader, man, this is it. You know, he's the poster boy for that. But he was, as we're finding out, looks can be deceiving, right? And he did have at the beginning, a decent start, maybe in the first year or two, it was maybe some hope. Okay, remember, he did avenge some enemies, and he gave some stability in that region. But we understand that his pride, his ego, and really he was just all over the place. It just caught up with them, and we're seeing he began to unravel rather quickly, and we're seeing that. So we kind of see that as inauguration. We did a kind of a geography lesson as well. And now we looked at last time in chapters 13, 14, and 15. This section here of Scripture really serves as a bridge between the justification of Israel's kingship and the rise of King David. So remember, up until this point, Israel did not have a king, did not have a monarchy. Remember, before them was the judges. Before the judges, you had Joshua. Before Joshua, had Moses, okay? And so what we're experiencing now is here in Samuel. I mean, let's say you read through the Bible in a year, okay? I do it twice in a year. And so where am I at? I'm in the Minor Prophets now. But nonetheless, when you go through this time, you go through a big chunk of the Bible, and there is no king of Israel. There's kind of hope and like a forecast of one, and even kind of a plan that God has set in place. But now, here you have it. Here we are in 1 Samuel, and now enter the king. So chapters 13 and 14 serves as a bridge of the justification of Israel's kingship. In other words, you're going to have a king, all right? And then you see that bridge is between here's King Saul, and all of a sudden Saul kind of wobbles, and then that brings you up to enter in David as the king, and that's in chapter 16. So Saul in chapter 13 had a challenge. Remember, one request that Israel had to Samuel. Remember, Samuel was the prophet, and they had requested, we want to have a king. And one of the reasons why they want a king is because, hey, we got enemies. We got bad guys on east and west of us. We have the Ammonites on the east and the Philistines on the west. We're caught in the middle. We need a ruler. We need a protector. We need a hero to kind of fight our battles for us. And of course, Samuel says, well, remember, if you do have a king, he's also going to probably take. Remember, we're talking about government. Government's job is to take. And that's exactly what Samuel forecasted, foretold, and Saul did it. And we're going to see in this story tonight a perfect example of what happened in that. So Saul had a challenge, and Saul's main purpose as Israel's king was to lead Israel in battle. His role as a king, though, remember how this was originally set up. Saul had to answer to a higher authority. There was God, of course, but also his prophet Samuel. The motto was this: standing beside every Israelite king was to be a prophet speaking God's word for that situation. The purpose was of this: God remained Israel's king represented by his prophet, who ordered God's anointed one, the Mashiach, or the, you could say, the little Messiah, or which were the kings, okay? And so, remember, each king was anointed, and that was a signifying of God's kind of bestowed title, if you will, upon them. So, and you see that throughout Israel's history, even in the divided kingdom, to an extent, you actually see that with every king, there is a prophet that is associated, or sometimes there's a couple of prophets. Again, going to the future, think of Hezekiah. The prophet that stood with Hezekiah was Isaiah. Okay, so that's just one example. So here's a classic one. You probably know this one better. Who was the prophet that came alongside King Ahab in northern Israel? Who was the prophet that countered or contrasted King Ahab in northern Israel? Elijah. Okay, Elijah. All right, and there's a big chunk of 1 Samuel that's dedicated to that relationship. Nonetheless, you see that model. So now, though, that we see this in chapter 13, there was a division in Saul's heart. Saul had a divided heart. That was his problem. He saw the pressure of the Philistines coming upon him, and he was told to wait for 7 days to offer a sacrifice by Samuel. But what remember what Saul was doing? He was saying, man, time's ticking, pressure's getting greater, my people are deserting me. Let's get on with it. Let's do a sacrifice, you know. What's the old saying? Sometimes it's easier to ask forgiveness than permission. He definitely lived that out, okay? So Saul had a divided heart, and that stepped him away from God and towards defeat. And because of that, Saul paid a price for his sin. And because of that, God rejected Saul's royal dynasty, basically that his kingdom would not last forever. So that's the idea. So let's now go to 1 Samuel. We're in chapter 14, but look at the very last verse of chapter 13. It says here, and the garrison of the Philistines went out to the passage or the passes of Michmash. Okay, so we are, again, if you remember our geography, if you still have those notes, you can refer to them, or maybe in the back of your Bible you have that. So if you go north of Jerusalem, about 8 miles, you're going to come to this area of Michmash. It's just a little bit east of Gibeah, where Saul had basically his capital, if you will, was there. And it's just a little bit west of Gilgal. So it's kind of in that region. And we talked about before, remember, the country of Israel is a really close area. It's a small landscape. And so this area is really, really close together. And so, but Michmash is just north, about 8 miles north of Jerusalem. It's kind of where we're at. And so there is a big issue that's going on. At the end of chapter 13, with all the pressure that's going on, there were some Israelites that deserted King Saul. And in doing that, some of them actually became mercenaries for the Philistines. They said they were actually hired as hitmen, if you will, or hired soldiers by the Philistines. And then on top of that, the Philistines had the monopoly on basically iron and sharpening everything. So, for example, it says here in verse 22, it came to pass the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people that were with Saul and Jonathan. But with Saul and Jonathan, his son, they were found. So you had an army of just really a couple thousand, really, but a couple 600 now. And the only people that have any major weapons were Saul and Jonathan. Everyone else was fighting with pitchforks, so to speak. Okay, not much of an army, so to speak. Not one that was scary anyway, okay? So this is what's happening. And so in the midst of this really helpless feeling, what's taking place? Now we come here into chapter 14. Let's begin by reading the first verse. Now it came to pass upon a day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said unto the young man that bears armor, come and let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side. But he told not his father. Verse 2, and Saul tarried in the uttermost part of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron, and the people that were with him were about 600 men. Wow, this is really setting up a couple things. So in your notes, follow along. We've got several notes here, and we'll try to get through it quickly here. So chapter 14 is a study to see what happens when a person's fellowship with God is broken. Remember, this just happened a little bit before this, maybe in the past couple of weeks, we don't know the time schedule, but relatively close period of time, that Saul, remember, he offers his sacrifice in haste. Samuel gets on him and he says, God has, basically, he is done with your dynasty is not going to go beyond you. In other words, Jonathan, your son, or any of your sons, will not become the next king. It's going to stop with you. So, with that, and what we're seeing is here that Saul's fellowship with God was shaky at this point. Now it's getting more shaky. And you're going to see what happens when a person's fellowship with God is broken. As we get into this tonight, a quick application for us is that we need to be very careful in maintaining our fellowship with God. Stay close to God. We sang a song, Nearer Still Nearer, this morning. How much we need to stay close to God. We talked about Abraham having a focus on heaven. That world is not his home. He's just passing through. His focus on heaven. How important for us to make sure that we are walking with the Lord. Saul wasn't doing that. His life was in turmoil. And because of that, we're going to see what happens when a person's fellowship with God is broken. Pay attention. So with that, chapter 14 presents us now with a contrast between Saul and Jonathan. There's a contrast between Saul and Jonathan. In verses 1 and 2, we get that already. We have Jonathan basically wanting to go into action. Let's go to get the Philistines. Let's go get them. And then in chapter 2, Saul is sitting under a pomegranate tree. Okay? We'll get to that in a second. But the reason for that is to set us up to see that Saul is going to be condemned. So this is a contrast between Saul and Jonathan in order to condemn Saul. In other words, the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. Was Saul a good king? Well, there were high hopes at the beginning, but we're seeing his true character. And this is going to set in motion. All this is doing, the failures of King Saul is preparing us. Isn't there going to be any good king? Is God ever going to give us a good king? Man, we're looking at Saul and saying, man, this isn't great. This is all setting us up for God's plan to have a king after his own heart, and that's David. Okay, that's setting us up for that. So, number three there, the purpose of this is to demonstrate that Saul is, actually this is in my notes, sorry, that the purpose of this is to demonstrate that Saul is going to be isolated for those around him. So this is a kind of like a look ahead, okay? In this chapter, we're going to see that Saul is going to become increasingly isolated from those around him. When someone breaks fellowship with God, it affects more than just their relationship with God. A person stops going to church, what's going to happen? They're going to lose fellowship, not just with the Lord, but they're going to lose fellowship with other believers too. Believers that are there to pray with them, encourage them, strengthen them, you know, help them, whatever it may be. When we distance ourselves from God, there's a ripple effect that affects other people in our lives as well. And we're going to see that spot on with Saul tonight. Okay, so with that in mind, we enter in. Here's the contrast. You got Saul on one hand, and then you got Jonathan, his son, on the other. And Jonathan emerges as a man full of courage and faith. He's a man full of courage and faith. Again, we just read verse 1. Look with me now in verse 6. Okay, Jonathan said unto the young man that bears armor, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised, that it may be that the Lord will work for us. For there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. And so Saul, Jonathan, as armor bearer, we're ready to go and excuse my allusion to the Princess Bride, but they're going to go and storm the castle, okay? If you watch that, you know exactly what I'm talking about, okay? But nonetheless, Jonathan probably remembered God's promise. In Leviticus 26:8, it says, God said this, and ye shall chase your enemies, and they shall fall before you by the sword. 5 of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight, and your enemies shall fall before you by the sword. And so as we see that, it's just Saul and Jonathan, two men going up a garrison, a well-fortified area, by the way, of the Philistines. And so they were going up against many. Okay, in fact, the Bible says later on that they killed as many as 20 men. And then before they started fighting amongst themselves. And so what's two guys against 20 guys that had better weapons? Okay, your odds aren't too great, right? And so, but anyways, Jonathan had courage and faith. Jonathan, here's another thing. This is kind of what Warren Wiersbe wrote in his book, Don't Lose Your Crown, concerning King Saul. Jonathan fought from victory, not for victory. We kind of think, man, if we just beat these guys, we will have victory. But Jonathan, For him, the victory was already won, as long as he followed the Lord. Here's the point. This is something, it's not in your notes, but maybe write it down somewhere. Jonathan's combat strategy, he was a fighter, he was a warrior. Jonathan's combat strategy was this. It was waiting for divine approval. Man, that's a big difference from King Saul. Jonathan's combat strategy was to wait for divine approval. He wanted God's approval. And you're saying, Pastor, what do you mean by that? Let's see what Jonathan said. Look with me in verse 8. Then said Jonathan, behold, we will pass over unto these men. We will discover, we're going to display ourselves, show ourselves to them. And if they say thus unto us, tarry until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place, and we will not go to them. Verse 10, this is key. But if they say to us, come up to us, and then we will go up. For the Lord hath delivered them into our hand, and this shall be a sign unto us. So they did that. They displayed themselves. Hey, here we are, guys. And the Philistines said, what? Come up, and we'll show you a thing or two. That was a sign of God. And so Jonathan's combat strategy was to wait for divine approval. Here's a big contrast between these two men. So let's look back at Saul now. We see Jonathan ready to storm the castle, storm the garrison. Saul, though, does what? Saul is presented here as out of touch and hesitant. Saul is presented as out of touch and hesitant. In verse 2, we find him sitting under a pomegranate tree in Gibeah. That was the capital. And with him were 600 men. Now, by the way, what he was doing here is he wasn't just sitting on a tree taking a nap. What he was doing there was acting in the role of, this is what the judges used to do. Back in Judges chapter 4, I believe, we have Deborah sitting under a palm tree being a judge of Israel. So he was doing business affairs of the kingdom, so to speak. He was not thinking of how to go in battle, for example. So that's what Saul is doing. But look with me in verse 17. When the battle started, remember Jonathan and Saul go up, they start killing the men, and then all of a sudden the Philistines started fighting with one another. The noise of that gets to the Israelite camp, and Saul says, what's going on? And he said, let's rally the troops. Look with me in verse 17. It says here, and they said, then said Saul unto the people that were with them, number now and see who is gone from us. And when they had numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. So Saul didn't even know where his own son was. He was out of touch. He was hesitant. He didn't know what was going on. He was, talk about a weak leader. He didn't even know where his army was or even where the son was. So Saul is presented as being out of touch and hesitant. Opposite him, Jonathan is a man of action. Jonathan is a man of action. He's ready to seize the day. Whereas Saul simply responds. Okay? Saul is kind of waiting for the battle to start, and then we'll see what happens after that. That's what you see in this passage. So Jonathan's a man of action. Saul simply just responds to the news. So this is what I want us to look at here now. So we see this battle, and Jonathan, through him, the Lord brings a victory. It wasn't Jonathan who brought the victory. The Lord used Jonathan to bring a victory, okay? And there's more to the story after that. But there's one thing I want us to see. And I invite you to read this a longer chapter, so read that on your own, the full text on your own. But there's one thing I want us to know. I'm going to ask you this question here. There is someone strangely absent from this chapter. Who is that? Samuel. Samuel's nowhere to be found in chapter 14. He's in every chapter that we've discussed. Actually, even go back to the first chapter or two. Samuel is integrated a lot in the story, especially with King Saul. Chapter 13, he's reprimanding Saul, okay? And now in chapter 14, with this battle going on, and even with Saul going on, there Samuel's nowhere to be found. That's interesting. Now, he'll come back again. We'll just hold your breath, okay? He'll come back again. But I want to focus on who took his place. Huh, interesting. Who was in place of Samuel? So go back with me to verse 3. 1 Samuel 14, verse 3. It says, and Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, wearing an ephod, and the people knew not that Jonathan was gone. So it talks about the people that were with Saul. There were 600 men, and then it mentions Ahijah, who was basically the priest. He was from the family of Eli. So you're looking at that, huh, that's interesting. So this is, why did, let's say Samuel, who is the author, I believe, of this, why did, we call it authorial intent, why did the writer of 1 Samuel put that verse in? This is one of those things that you circle it, make you wonder, why is he there? So this is where we put our thinking cap on. So let's talk about that briefly here. Ahijah, or Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest and child. So let's kind of work backwards in this. So Ahijah, or Ahijah, is serving as, think of as the chaplain for Saul's army. He's the priest. He carries an ephod with him, which helps direct, it's basically to help seek God's direction, maybe in battle, for example. And so that's who this is. But look at how he is presented here. He is the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli. So who is Eli? Eli is the priest that we find at the beginning of 1 Samuel. Okay? He is the one who he had, that's where Hannah, Samuel's mother, remember she was praying for a son, and Eli saw her, remember he thought she was drunk and all that, and all of a sudden, you know, you're going to have a son by this time next year. And anyway, she weaned him, and then she presented him to the Lord. Samuel then served with Eli at the tabernacle in Shiloh. Okay? So that's who that is. But remember Eli, and we see this, remember there's this pattern in the book of 1 Samuel of fathers and sons, that remember that, remember Samuel had two sons. Remember going back to when Israel wanted a new king, they said, your sons aren't leading us right. Remember, they were taking bribes. They weren't straight folks, okay? So they had that. And then you also had Eli and his two sons. Now, did Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were they good guys? They were wicked. And God, basically, God killed them, in a sense, in a battle. And so, and because of that, remember what did happen. Remember, we're introduced to Samuel's first words back a couple chapters earlier. And remember, he hears God, or here, he thought it was Eli speaking, and he says, speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth. He goes, and remember that God tells Samuel at this young age that I am basically going to cut off the house of Eli because of the wickedness and the corruption that's been going on here. You kind of feel sorry for Eli. I think he tried, but it was just a faulty family. It really was. With that in mind, we are seeing this, that this family here is going to happen. Now, what happens is this. Eli, his two sons, they die in battle. Remember, they were carrying the Ark of the Covenant to fight against the Philistines. This would be long before Saul and all that. And remember that the Philistines took the Ark of the Covenant, and they killed Hophni and Phinehas. And when news got back to Eli, what happened? He fell off his chair and broke his neck, and he died. And then it's interesting that Phinehas's wife was bearing, was in childbirth, and she would die in childbirth. And she had a son named Ichabod. And Ichabod, why is his name Ichabod? Not Ichabod Crane, if you're a Washington Irving fan from early American literature. All right. I digress. But Ichabod, this is Ichabod who is, what does his name mean? Does anyone remember? What does Ichabod mean?
The glory has departed.
Exactly. The glory has departed. The glory has left is the idea. And because the glory has left Israel with the Ark of the Covenant being stolen. Okay. So his brother, younger brother, Ahitub, older brother, Ahitub, he has a son named Ahijah or Ahijah. So I say all that to say this. There's a reason why that brief lineage is right here in chapter 3. This is really important. So let me just ask you, big picture version. What would God say would happen concerning Eli's family? It would be cut off, right? It would not, remember, this is not going to be the way God would replace it with a different, with Zadok later on during the time of David. So here's the important thing. The presence of the priest Ahijah instead of Samuel. The presence of the priest Ahijah stresses the rejection of the house of Eli and the house of Saul. Here you have two men, two families that basically God has rejected them. God rejected the house of Eli. God rejected the house of Saul. So here's the important thing. The mention of Ichabod's name here implies where Saul is at spiritually. The glory has departed. So Saul's royal glory is almost gone. And it's appropriate that he associates with a relative of the man named the glory has departed. Just as Eli's family, the glory has departed, Saul's glory is departing as well. So you're seeing a digression of Saul is what's happening. Saul here turned from the legitimate counsel of Samuel, who, remember, that was God's plan. Listen to Samuel. And to the discredited line of Eli. That's what's happening. Here's a question for us today. In our own lives, I pray that we have a Samuel in our life. Someone who speaks truth, God's truth to us. Okay? But here's a question. Have we replaced Samuel with an Ahijah in our lives? Someone who is not quite up to par as far as being God's messenger. Not at the right place at the right time. Have we replaced Samuel with Ahijah? In other words, it's important who we listen to. Who we allow to speak truth into our life. That's very important. Okay? So, moving on. Saul's approach now to the battle changed in a couple ways. Look with me in verse 19, or it's going to be 18. It says here, get the right chapter. It says here, and Saul said unto Ahijah, bring hither the ark of God, for the ark of God was at that time with the children of Israel. And it came to pass, while Saul talked unto the priest, that the noise that was at the host of the Philistines went on and increased. And Saul said unto the priest, withdraw thy hand. Oh, this is really interesting. Okay? So, the battle is going on. They hear this noise of the Philistines fighting each other. And now, this is what is happening. Remember, Saul, he's out of touch. He's hesitant. And we see a couple things. His approach to the battle changed. He started from watching. He was just a spectator, okay? He was watching the battle. And then now in verses 18 and 19, he's inquiring of the Lord. He says to Ahijah, bring the Ark of the Covenant, bring the ephod, and let's see what the Lord's will be done. And look with me in verse 19 again. Look at this. This is just fascinating. He says here, and Saul talked to the priest, okay? And then Saul said to the... Okay, so he brings the Ark of the Covenant. He says, okay, let's, priest Ahijah, let's talk to the Lord about this, get the Lord's counsel. And then, all of a sudden, as the priest was about to do it, he says at the very end of verse 19, withdraw thy hand. Basically, the idea is here, there's no use. Let's just get on. Okay, the battle's starting. We're late. Let's go. That's what's happening. So, what's going on? As Joe Biden would say, come on, man. That's my best impression. All right. So he goes from watching to inquiring of the Lord, which that was very short-lived, and now he's joining the fight. He gets all the men together, and people started coming, and yes, it was a great time, and they go and they start joining the battle. That was the idea. But you see here, in this brief moment, Saul's just a roller coaster. He's all over the place. He doesn't know what to do with himself. He was a double-minded man, and double-minded man is unstable in all their ways. So here's something very important here. Saul's sudden reversal exposes his uncertainty. It exposes his uncertainty. He was not a sure mind, was he? He exposes his uncertainty. It reminds us of his impulsive and impatient sacrifice from chapter 13. In other words, he just continues on in this behavior. Okay? So he is very uncertain. All right. So now what we have is this. The battle is going on, and Saul makes this outrageous claim. The battle is going on. The men are there. They're ready to fight. And in verse 24, it says here, and the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had adjured the people, saying, cursed be the man that eateth any food until evening, that I may become avenged of my enemies. So none of the people tasted any food. In other words, okay, guys, we're going to fight, but we can't eat. No one's allowed to eat until after the battle's done. What's happening here is this. Saul's rash command for the army not to eat gave the appearance of a holy vow. In other words, he came across sounding very pious, very religious, if you will. In other words, guys, we're going to go into battle, but I think we should all fast and pray until the battle's over. That's what's happening. Saul makes this outrageous. He goes from one extreme to the other. Okay? Here's a good point. Those who have served in the military or the Navy, okay, to be specific, an army moves on its stomach. Army guys are not much good if they don't eat, right? You'll learn that very quickly. Saul here, he basically takes that part, and the people were distressed. What happens, though, a little bit later is this. They were fighting, And the people, they were just famished. It says here in verse 28, or 26, and when the people were come to the wood, the forest, behold, the honey dropped, but no man put his hand to the mouth, for they remembered their oath. But, here's the contrast, Jonathan heard not when his father charged the people with the oath. Wherefore he put forth the end of the rod that was in his hand, and dipped it in the honeycomb, put it to his hand to his mouth, and one of my favorite verses in the Bible, and his eyes were enlightened. Guys, have you ever, and ladies too, whoever, have you ever been so hungry? Or maybe in the morning, you know, let's say you had a fast because of a doctor's appointment, had to do labs or whatever. You get home and say, man, I can't wait to eat. You take that first bite, maybe honey, and it's like, wow, that was amazing. I could just imagine Jonathan doing that. One of my favorite verses of the Bible, maybe because I like have a good appetite. I don't know. But nonetheless, here's what's happening. Again, Saul and Jonathan are contrasted. Jonathan benefits from the honey. It strengthens him. He goes onto the battle. Whereas Saul beleaguered the troops. Saul beleaguered the troops. He made it difficult for his troops to function. Verse 29. Look what Jonathan says. Then said Jonathan, my father had troubled the land. See, I pray you how my eyes have been enlightened. I'm strengthened because I have tasted a little honey. How much more if happily the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found, and here there have now been much greater slaughter than among the Philistines. Hey, we could have whipped these guys if we just were able to eat. We could have gotten the job done. But he calls out his dad. Saul, you should... It doesn't make any sense. Here's a quote by commentator Bill T. Arnold. Whereas Saul, the commander, publicly dishonored the Lord through fear-inspired obedience, and that was, it was fear-inspired. If you don't eat, you're done, okay? But that was disobedience. Jonathan the warrior would bring honor through his fearless faith. That's beautiful. What happened in the end of this, Saul's foolish command leads Israel to sin because they ended up getting cattle and sheep and all that, and they, after the battle, they just slaughtered and they started eating and eating with blood. According to Levitical law, that was a no-no. You don't eat blood with the meat. And so it caused Israel to sin. Now what happens is this. Saul calls on the name of the Lord. Verse 35 says here, and Saul built an altar unto the Lord, the same that was at the first altar he built unto the Lord. And Saul said, let us go down after the Philistines by night and spoil them until the morning light, and let them not leave a man of them. And they said, do whatsoever seemed good unto thee. And then said the priest, there's Ahijah again, let us draw near hither to God, unto God. And Saul asked counsel of God, shall I go down after the Philistines? Wilt thou deliver them into the hand of God? So Saul is reaching out to the Lord. God, is it your will for us to go after the Philistines? At the very end of 37. But he answered him not that day. God did not give a response. Here's the point. This is number 10 in your notes. Saul's call on the Lord was met by a divine silence. It was met by divine silence, which signifies divine displeasure. Saul's call to the Lord was met by divine silence, which signifies divine displeasure. In other words, God was not pleased, not with Jonathan, with Saul. That was, and really with Ahijah too. Okay? So that was going on. In doing that, what happens next is very interesting. Saul's actions isolated himself. And we talked about that earlier. Remember, when you distance yourself from God, you're going to distance yourself from other people. In the case of this, what happens? Saul's actions isolate himself, first of all, from Samuel. We saw that from last chapter. He isolates it from some Samuel. Next, his army. Look at me in verse 39. This is interesting. It says here, Saul is saying this, for as the Lord liveth, which saveth Israel, though it be Jonathan my son, he shall surely die because of eating of that food. But there was not a man among the people that answered him. The army wasn't going to turn in Jonathan. In fact, later on, they were for Jonathan. Okay? And so Saul's action is isolate himself from Samuel, his army, and also his son, even from Jonathan as well. So understand this. When we're living in sin and rebelling against God, it becomes a very lonely life. It really does. Be careful. Be careful of your walk with the Lord. Okay? So, we conclude this tonight. Verses 47 through 52, the last verses there, are really kind of a little bit of a history of his exploits, defeating the Philistines, Zobah, Moab, Ammon, etc., the Amalekites. And then in starting in verse 49, it talks about his family lineage, his sons, Jonathan, Yeshua, and Melchishua. By the way, Saul did have more children than this, but the reason that these are mentioned is because these are the ones that will give yourself a preview. These are the same ones that will die in the battle at the end of 1 Samuel. That's why they're mentioned here. Okay. So anyways, you see his family tree, you see Abner, and then at the very end, it says here, and there was sore war against the Philistines all the days of Saul. When Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he took him unto him. Remember what Samuel said at the beginning? Okay, you can have a king, but he's going to take. Here we have Exhibit A, verse 52. And he took anyone who basically had a pulse. And come on my team, because we have an enemy we're fighting. That's what happened. So go back here in number 12 in your notes here, the 13. Okay. The summary of Saul's reign is notable, as there is no mention. It's interesting, if you read through that, there's someone also not mentioned. In this chapter, Samuel's name is not mentioned, but also who is it mentioned here in verses 47 through 42? In Saul's exploits and his family tree, there's someone's name not mentioned. Who is that? God. The summary of Saul's reign is notable, as there is no mention of the name of God. That's very telling, because when you look at King David, you go to 2 Samuel chapter 8, for example, and you read of the exploits of David, you'll see how the Lord was with him. The Lord helped him in this battle and that battle. But here, in all this, God's name is not mentioned. That, again, is another indicator of seeing how much Saul had fallen away from the Lord. So, in conclusion, Saul's life, looking at this chapter, chapter 14, Saul's life illustrates that God's people are not capable of self-rule. They're not capable of self-rule. How much we do that as well. We think we can handle life on our own, right? We can make decisions however we want. No one's going to be affected. It's just me. Guess what? No one is capable of self-rule. You don't have mastery over your own soul. You might think you do. But remember what we say this, and we've said it many times here. Just two choices on the shelf. Pleasing God or pleasing self. Okay? Keep that in mind. The last note there. Faith, and this applies to Abraham we talked about this morning. Faith implies what? Dependence upon the Lord. Faith implies dependence upon the Lord. One of the big reasons that Saul failed and failed and failed again is because he was depending on his own strength and not on the Lord. This is, again, a warning for us that we need to keep our eyes fixed upon the Lord, stay close to the Lord, obey his word, and in doing that, depend on him, having the faith that is strong. So, folks, here is chapter 14, kind of like a drinking out of a fire hose version, but nonetheless, a good overview of that. So next week we'll be back and we'll go into the third defeat of King Saul. That's in chapter 15, and we'll see what happens there.